Hello there. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington.
And I'm Steve Miller. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump's phone call emboldens House Democrats to seek more information.
Also ahead, climate activist Greta Thunberg has strong words for world leaders at the U.N. General Assembly.
Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil.
And just what went wrong with travel icon Thomas Cook? Those stories and more are next. U.S. President Donald Trump is denying that he told the president of Ukraine that his country would only get U.S. aid if they investigated the son of Democratic rival Joe Biden. During a meeting Monday on the sidelines of the United Nations, Trump emphatically said, "I didn't do it."
There was no pressure put on them whatsoever. I put no pressure on them whatsoever. I could have. I think it would probably, possibly have been okay if I did. But I didn't. I didn't put any pressure on them whatsoever. You know why? Because they want to do the right thing, and they know about corruption, and they probably know that Joe Biden and his son are corrupt.
His comments come amid reports he pressured Ukraine's leader to help investigate political rival Joe Biden. At the same time, the White House was withholding $250 million in aid to the Eastern European nation. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekurswara joins us now. So I guess where I want to start with today is, of course, the president's comments regarding former Vice President Joe Biden. What has kind of been the reaction so far from Democrats?
Well, yes, you're right. And the president really is doubling down, accusing Joe Biden and his son of corruption, while at the same time defending his call with Ukrainian leader President Zelensky last July. So today at the UN General Assembly, President Trump said that what Biden did is a disgrace. What his son did is a disgrace. The son took money from Ukraine. The son took money from China without offering evidence to back this statement. So, of course, Joe Biden pushed back on the campaign trail, saying that the president is abusing presidential power to smear him and that he's doing this because, and I quote, "he knows I'll beat him like a drum." So there's pushback from the Democrats, not just from Joe Biden, but also from Nancy Pelosi, as you know, have sent a letter to the White House demanding them to turn the whistleblower's information by Thursday. Democratic chairs of the committees, House Intelligence, Oversight and Foreign Affairs, also sent a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo demanding that he produce documents related to the allegations. But really, so far, the administration has refused to cooperate, and that's where things currently stand. Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, is scheduled to testify publicly before the House Intelligence Committee on Thursday. But again, it's unclear if he's willing to give any kind of information. And this may be ending up as something that gets decided on the court.
That is one thing that happened with the president today. He, of course, was having his own event as the UN was discussing climate change. He was holding the global call to protect religious freedom. What can you tell us about that event?
Right. Yeah. So this is interesting because we discussed this yesterday. And one of the questions, one of the things to look out for was whether the president will speak about protection of all religious minorities and not just Christian minorities, which would be a message to his base. And today, the president did make a point that his administration has taken steps to protect all victims, protect victims of all religious violence, including Jews, Yazidis who suffered at the hands of ISIS, Rohingya Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Sikhs. He even mentioned non-believers, basically every group who has been persecuted over their beliefs. But the experts that I've spoken to still question the genuineness behind this call because the president's track record on religion has been rather patchy. We remember that during his campaign for president, he proposed a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. So it really remains to be seen what kind of actions will be taken following this initiative.
He also had a number of bilateral meetings today, most notably with Pakistan and South Korea.
Yeah, so Pakistan was quite interesting. The president said that he hoped India and Pakistan could come together to resolve their differences over Kashmir. As we know, the president was with Prime Minister Modi at this event in Texas called Howdy Modi, huge event, and the president showing up is basically a show of support for the Indian Prime Minister. So As we know, President Trump has offered to mediate on Kashmir, which the Prime Minister Modi has declined, saying that it's an issue between India and Pakistan.
And what about South Korea?
Yeah, so in the bilat with South Korea, President Trump seems to be staying in line with his policy on North Korea, really dismissing their missile test, which obviously the South Koreans are much more concerned, even with just short-range missile tests. But the President Trump is insisting that there are no nuclear testing at all for quite a long period of time, and that his relationship with Kim Jong-un has been very good, and that Kim has lived up to his word.
Really quickly, before I let you go, what about Iran?
Well, President Trump, during one of his bilaterals, I believe it's with the Egyptian President al-Sisi, said that no meeting has been scheduled with Iran. The thing to look out for tomorrow is, of course, a speech by President Trump in the morning, as well as President Rouhani following him not long after that. And then we'll see how the other world leaders respond in terms of the dynamic between the U.S. on Iran over this Saudi oil facility attack.
Patsy Wiedekuswara reports from the White House for VOA. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Well, world leaders, as you just heard, have been gathering in New York for United Nations Summit on climate change. That was the focus on Monday, as scientists warn much more ambitious action must be taken to meet targets to mitigate the effects. Some 60 presidents and prime ministers addressed the day-long event on topics including shifting away from coal toward renewable energy sources, preventing and responding to disasters, and climate finance. 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg gave her most impassioned speech yet, where she scolded world leaders, saying all of them have offered empty words. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
16-year-old Greta Thunberg spoke emotionally about a crisis created by adults, but whose consequences will be borne by her generation.
You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you.
Thunberg warned the more than 60 presidents and prime ministers gathered in the UN General Assembly Hall that the youth would not let them get away with this, and that change is coming whether they like it or not. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres backed her up.
My generation has failed in its responsibility to protect our planet. That must change.
Guterres has called for the phasing out of fossil fuels and an end to the construction of new coal power plants. Numerous leaders, including some of the world's biggest polluters, came with pledges to cut their carbon emissions and transition away from dirty energy, including coal. U.S. President Donald Trump, who declared his intention to withdraw the United States from the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement 6 months after he took office, was not expected to attend the summit. He did, however, turn up in the audience for about 15 minutes to listen to other leaders' speeches. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Meanwhile, climate change is taking a huge toll on Americans' health, so much so that it could constitute a public health crisis, according to a new study by the Natural Resources Defense Council and the University of California, San Francisco. Joining us to talk about that part of the story, one of the authors of this study from the Natural Resources Defense Council, senior scientist Dr. Kim Knowlton.
There's been a lack of evidence on the public health effects and the economic toll of the public health harms climate change. There's a lot of evidence, a lot of research that connects the dots between climate change and health. But the cost to people and the cost to society and to our healthcare system has really been absent. That's really why we undertook, researchers at the Natural Resources Defense Council, myself included, and at the University of California in San Francisco, UCSF, and we looked at events that have already happened here and now in the U.S. We wanted to see if we could estimate the health costs of 10 climate-sensitive events that happened here in the U.S. in the year 2012. And we looked at a wide range of locations, extreme events, and the health harms that they caused so that it'd be relatable and really applicable to the experience that so many of us have these days in the face of climate change. We looked at costs from wildfires and their health effects in Colorado and Washington. We looked at ozone air pollution in Nevada, extreme heat in Wisconsin, infectious disease outbreaks of Lyme disease in Michigan and West Nile virus in Texas, extreme weather and rainfall in Ohio, Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey and New York, allergenic oak pollen in North Carolina, and harmful algal blooms on the Florida coast. So it was one of the first times that such a wide range and locations have been evaluated. But what we found is that we're already paying out $10 billion in health-related costs just from those 10 events that have already happened. About 900 deaths, 21,000 hospitalizations, 18,000 emergency room visits, and 37,000 outpatient encounters. Those affect all of us. It's really a public health emergency.
Was this study started in 2012, or is that how far you just chose to go back and look?
2012 was the year in which we collected evidence from dozens of sources in a way that isn't usually done. One needs to look at a variety of sources, because right now in the U.S., there isn't one integrated, coordinated tracking system that looks at extreme events and their health effects, and certainly not at the cost. So we looked at 2012 because it was really the most recent year for which we could gather data for that wide range of events that we really sought to gather together and estimate costs for.
Things have gotten, it would appear, significantly worse when it comes to a lot of environmental issues and climate change. It certainly seems to have really sped up. So I wonder what it would show now.
Indeed, the five hottest years globally on record have been the last 5 years. Climate change is really going from a global warming effect that we used to think was happening in a time and place distant to here and now, and this report really spells that out. It's projected that these climate and health harms are going to increase in future years, so it's extremely likely that the cost would increase too. And it's really just the tip of the iceberg that this study details. It's just 10 of these case study events, and certainly there are many more climate-sensitive events that have health impacts that are already happening in the U.S.
What are some of the health issues that you have found with this study, and what do you anticipate in the future?
Well, there are a really wide range of health effects, from, unfortunately, premature deaths that happened as a result of these extreme events to more need for medications, to home health care visits. It's a very wide range of effects that's affecting millions of us in the U.S. It also showed that the groups of people who we've known for a long time tend to be more vulnerable to the health effects of climate change indeed are, and they're shouldering a bigger proportion of the cost. There was really a disproportionate share of illness-related costs of these events, like 64%, that were paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So we hope that this study will help illuminate how important it is for us to deal with climate and health vulnerability right now, and hopefully avoid those costs by really putting better preparedness and better tracking systems into place. Through the work of this study, when we consider how much we are paying for climate change right now with our health, with our dollars, this becomes an issue that is, you know, closer than ever to home. It's important that we not think of climate change as a hypothetical future risk. It's very much here and now. It really is a public health emergency. We're all going to have to pay to deal with climate change one way or another. But this study, we hope, helps to show that we don't want to continue paying for it with our health.
It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to, like you're saying, put a human impact on it. But then when you're seeing real people coming forward saying, this is what I'm dealing with.
Yes. When we did the telepresser event with two emergency room physicians, their insights were so stunning. And they're from state of Washington and Colorado. They saw people come in by the dozens, then by the hundreds over their wildfire seasons in recent years. And it's extremely sobering. They see firsthand how many people are suffering dramatically and dying from not just the flames, but from the long-term impacts of wildfire smoke. So people like that have the personal experience, but you have hit the challenge on the head. Mm-hmm. How can we all grasp this challenge, which affects us all? No one is going to get to sit this one out.
That is Dr. Kim Nolan. She's a senior scientist and one of the authors of the new study by the Natural Resources Defense Council and the University of California.
A long-awaited Syrian Constitutional Committee has been finalized after nearly 2 years of negotiations and is set to convene in the coming weeks, according to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Guterres told reporters at the UN headquarters that the Syrian government and opposition ironed out all their differences on an agreement which is to create a 150-member committee made up of members of both sides as well as civil society members. It is tasked with drafting a new constitution for the civil war-torn nation in talks facilitated by the UN in Geneva. The committee is seen as an important step towards potentially ending the more than 8-year conflict, which has killed over 400,000 people. Israel's president summoned the leaders of the country's two largest political parties to his office official residence late Monday, hoping to break a political deadlock that threatens to push the nation into months of limbo and potentially force a third election in less than a year. A joint statement after the meeting, the sides of the negotiators said that they would continue talks Tuesday and that President Rivlin had invited the two leaders back to meet with him on Wednesday evening. They gave no further details about the discussions.
French President Emmanuel Macron on Monday was talking with both President Donald Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, hoping to ease rising tension between Washington and Tehran. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has details from the United Nations.
Text in 5-4-3-2-1. Trump appears to be rebuffing Macron's efforts with Iran.
We're not looking for any mediators. They know who to call.
In a joint statement, Britain, France, and Germany are holding Iran responsible for recent attacks on Saudi oil installations, which has prompted concerns about the possibility of war between the West and the Islamic Republic. Trump says he'll be talking about Iran's aggression in his address Tuesday to the UN General Assembly. Steve Herman at the United Nations.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to a new study published in the journal Science, birdwatchers in the U.S. and Canada have 29% or 3 billion fewer birds to observe than they had in 1970. While the study didn't investigate specific causes for this drop in bird population, the researchers did find that a significant driving factor is the extensive loss and degradation of the bird's habitat from human activity, such as agriculture and urbanization. The study shows that 12 bird families make up more than 90% of the losses. Among the birds who have disappeared, according to the study, are sparrows, blackbirds, warblers, and finches. The study authors made their findings by analyzing bird survey datasets that were made by people who actually count the birds they see for such programs as the U.S. Geological Survey's Breeding Bird Survey and the Audubon Society's annual Christmas Bird Count. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Families have been stranded. Honeymoons and vacations were canceled and thousands of workers laid off. It's the aftermath of the sudden collapse of British tour company Thomas Cook and its network of airlines and hotels that have sowed chaos for hundreds of thousands of travelers and businesses around the world. It took place on Monday, like Leanne, who was in Glasgow.
Scared about getting home. Disappointed, but just glad now that I can get home today, because was worried, starting to worry that I'd have to stay here for longer time. So just glad to get home.
This 178-year-old travel agency that helped pioneer the package tour industry ceased operating in the middle of the night. Its four airlines stopped carrying customers, and its 21,000 employees in 16 countries lost their jobs. Joining us with the latest is London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, can you help me unpack what exactly is going on this Monday after the announcement last night that Thomas Cook is belly up?
This is one of the most famous names in travel, not only in Britain, but across Europe and in other parts of the world as well. 150,000 British customers alone are on Thomas Cook holidays, or were on Thomas Cook holidays, with close to a million future bookings made with the company in this country alone. And it seems that a perfect storm of circumstances led to the collapse of the company. In truth, it hasn't been a sudden demise. It has been a long time coming, but it's been a combination of a business that many analysts see was stuck in old ways. It had many high street stores trying to sell holidays when many of its competitors have moved online into far cheaper ways of doing business. And there were some political events which hit bookings, for example, the political turbulence in Turkey 3 years ago, and also, of course, the uncertainty over Brexit and the weak pound has meant that British holidaymakers aren't getting as much value, and they have perhaps preferred to stay at home. So this combination of factors appears to have created these problems for Thomas Cook. It got overburdened with debt, and there was a Chinese investor, its main investor, that was going to come to the rescue, close to £1 billion, but at the last minute, the banks that were backing Thomas Cook demanded an extra £200 million, and it just couldn't meet that demand. The government was asked to step in, the British government, but it said that it's not the government's place to support a failing private business. And so in the early hours of the morning, the business collapsed. Its planes were impounded, its staff told that they were going to lose their jobs, and now the long process begins of trying to get all those holidaymakers back from where they are.
Can you talk a little bit about what is being done to help repatriate those who were on holiday with bookings from Thomas Cook? Because, we're, as you said, we're talking, you know, 150,000 British personnel, you know, a lot more from around the world that are essentially left out in the wind at this point.
Exactly. Well, the last flight that Thomas Cook owned its own airline as well. It's important to say this. It was such a broad business that it had its own planes and airline. The last Thomas Cook flight landed at Manchester Airport in Britain in the early hours of the morning from Orlando in Florida. So those were the last customers to get home. Now, the British government has put together a fleet of about 60 airplanes that it will continue to fly, a sort of shadow airline, for the next 2 weeks to try to bring home those 150,000 British customers. Now, not to mention the other nationalities that you spoke of. There are even more German customers, I believe, who are on holiday. But the British customers will be brought home at the expense of the British taxpayer. And that's expected to cost around $100 million to get all of those holidaymakers home and compensate all of the hotels that we've been missing out on that money and so on. Across the globe as well, we should also talk about those Thomas Cook staff who are facing losing their jobs. Now, 9,000 in Britain alone. Across the globe, we're talking many hotel staff, operators and so on. 22,000 people were employed by Thomas Cook now and are now facing looking for new jobs.
What are people in London saying about this?
There is a great amount of shock. This is an absolutely iconic name. It was founded in 1841, so almost 180 years ago in Britain. And it's been a common name across the industry for many, many years, and one that many people trusted. Indeed, many of the customers who are now being repatriated from their holidays say they only chose a Thomas Cook holiday because it was a trusted name. They'd rather go with them than others. I think among business groups and analysts, there is an understanding that this was a business that wasn't modernizing quickly enough. And how many times have we seen that with other sectors, that online retail, whether it's huge companies like Amazon competing with the high street, or in this case, airlines that sell directly to customers online, sites like booking.com, hotels.com, where you can make your own holiday. You don't need an agent to do it anymore. So the major fear now, I think, is that there are other tour operators out there who have a similar business model who might be vulnerable as well. And I think that will be the major fear for the government at the moment. But there will also be a big post-mortem about what exactly did go wrong with this company.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, interior ministers from five European countries reached a preliminary agreement on how to distribute migrants picked up in the central Mediterranean. The agreement was reached Monday during a meeting in Malta and is scheduled to be discussed by all European Union members next month. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
EU Migration and Home Affairs Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos said good progress was made in Malta towards a predictable and structural set of arrangements to deal with migrants rescued in the Mediterranean. He said the ministers worked to find practical solutions to respond together in a spirit of solidarity to the migratory challenges.
We all agree that the current ad hoc approach, consisting of the Commission coordinating solidarity efforts, it's time a vessel with migrants is at sea is simply not sustainable.
Malta's Interior Minister Michael Farrugia, who hosted the meeting, which also included Germany, France, Italy and Finland, said an agreement was reached on the disembarkation of migrants following search and rescue operations. He said a paper was ready to be presented to the other EU members.
There is an agreement of a common paper that will be presented to the councils of ministers of Home Affairs on the 8th of October.
Under the preliminary agreement, vessels which rescue people at sea will be given a safe harbour to disembark passengers without delay, avoiding additional hardships to migrants. The agreement also calls for the swift relocation of asylum seekers on a voluntary basis to other member states. Avramopoulos said the migrant crisis is a responsibility for all of the EU, which must be addressed collectively. He added that the European Commission would continue to provide active support to member states struggling with the burden of migration, adding that this support would be operational, financial and political.
I remain convinced that a structural and permanent solution embedded in the common European asylum system remains necessary and is the only viable solution in the medium term.
Italy and Malta have in recent months closed their ports to NGO vessels that rescued migrants, but those policies are likely to change with the new agreements now being discussed. Thousands of migrants from Africa and the Middle East continue their efforts to reach European shores, sometimes on very unsafe vessels. Both Italy and Malta have long accused other EU nations of dragging their feet on the migration burden they face on a daily basis. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Medieval drama Game of Thrones closed its run with a fourth Emmy Award for Best Drama Series, while Fleabag was the upset winner for the Best Comedy Series on Sunday nights in Los Angeles. Eve Johnson from Reuters News has the story.
Game of Thrones.
HBO's medieval fantasy series stormed the Emmy Awards Sunday night, taking home 12 trophies, including the top prize, Best Drama. The night marks a final bow for Game of Thrones as it closes its run on HBO. Peter Dinklage took the only acting trophy of the bunch for his supporting role as Tyrion Lannister.
No other place could I be standing on a stage like this.
You know when you've done everything?
But the breakout star of the night was Amazon Studios' Fleabag, scooping up the prize for Best Comedy. Its creator and star, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, grabbed a trophy each for Best Comedy Writing and Actress.
It's just really wonderful that to know and reassuring that a dirty, pervy, angry, messed up woman can make it to the Emmys. So thank you so much. Thank you.
And in an Emmy's first, an openly gay black man won Best Drama Actor. Broadway veteran Billy Porter won the prize for his starring role in LGBTQ series Pose.
Oh my God, God bless you all. The category is love, y'all, love!
Wow, you look amazing. Can I
the night paid tribute to some newcomers as well. Jodie Comer won a trophy for Best Actress, playing a psychotic assassin in Killing Eve. And Jarrell Jerome won Best Actor for his role in When They See Us. The Netflix drama is based on the story of the Central Park Five, wrongly accused of rape.
This is for the men that we know as the Exonerated Five. It's for Raymond, Yusuf, Antron, Kevin, and King Corey Wise!
HBO's limited series Chernobyl, based on a Soviet nuclear accident, also made a strong showing, taking home 10 trophies. In the final count, HBO won the night, edging out Netflix with 34 Emmys and new bragging rights in the battle for viewers.
And that was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Nick Ivanoff, and managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening.
And you can find expanded coverage of all the world events and news we're covering at voanews.com. And don't forget our mobile app. You can download the stories and take them home with you. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Steve Miller. Good night.
This is VOA.